I don't know. I think this one is cut pretty deep, but if he does get back out there and is scoring goals in black and white, eventually I'm sure there'll be a bit of forgiveness from the fans.
Oh, what a forgiving fellow you potentially are. I'll tell you, it depends how many goals he scores.
That's true. Yeah,
because if he's not scoring, you're going to be pretty hard.
And in which end?
That's right. Ollie, thank you so much. We are not quite out of time, but I'm thrilled to say that Fee and Jane have just walked in and they're both looking as though they're very excited about today's programme. So, with that in mind, Jane, just give me 20 seconds about what's coming up.
Well, I can tell you, we are talking about space. We're very, very excited about the Pope's new flatmates. And what
else?
The
Pope does not have flatmates. Well, Stop it.
Not at the moment he doesn't, but he's going to have some, isn't he?
He's going to have three friars are joining him.
Yeah. Three friars. Yeah. I'm tuning in. I'm not going anywhere. But for now, I simply have to say thank you for listening to The Times at One. I'll be back tomorrow and Fee and Jane are coming up.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It is 2 o'clock. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until four, and here she is. What have we got? I think I might have already said it. Say it again.
It's too much of a build-up. What's next for our space sector following the government takeover of the UK Space Agency? The big question of the day, obviously, what sort of housemate will the Pope make? And our big interview today is with the Sunday Times' Sean Linton on the abandoned children of the sodium valproate scandal.
We'll start with the news at two. Martin Williams.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. The government says it's looking to find contingency options for migrants forced to leave a hotel in Essex. High Court ruling means asylum seekers will be removed from the Bell in Epping due to planning laws. It's expected to lead to more local authorities across England making legal challenges. Karina Gander is the leader of the Conservative-led Broxbourne Council. She's told Times Radio a migrant hotel in her area should also close.
We will be looking at all routes and we will be looking at everything as it comes to us. This isn't going to happen overnight, and every challenge that we have and everything that comes to us, we will deal with as and when it happens. And we will also be looking at Epping, and we are right behind them. So what happens to their hotel and to the people in their hotel, you know, we'll look at how they deal with that, and we'll be looking to do the same.
Official figures suggest prices are now rising at their fastest rate since the beginning of last year. Inflation hit a higher than expected 3.8% last month. Professor Stephen Millard is Deputy Director at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research.
The precise reason for the jump in July was the fact that the normal increase in airfares that kicks in once the American university students are on holiday mid-June, it actually fell after the June collection point. So we'd normally see a jump in airfares in June. We saw it instead in the July data. That was why we had the jump in inflation this month.
A man's been stabbed to death near Wembley Stadium in North London. The victim, who was 38, was attacked at around 6 o'clock last night. Detectives say his family's being supported by specialist officers. A 26-year-old man's been arrested on suspicion of murder. A woman aged 31 is being held for alleged conspiracy to murder. A member of the rap trio Kneecaps being greeted by supporters outside court after being bailed over allegedly supporting a proscribed terror organisation. Liam O'Hanley is accused of displaying a flag in support of Hezbollah at a gig in London in November last year. Hundreds of fans gathered outside Westminster Magistrates with signs reading Free Mo Chara, his stage name. The 27-year-old has yet to enter a plea and is due to appear in court again next month. Staff at Airbus are going on strike in a row over pay. Unite says around 3,000 of its members based in Broughton in North Wales and Filton near Bristol will walk out for 10 days in September. The union warns the industrial action will hit production of wings for the company's commercial and military aircraft programmes. And a man's appeared in court charged with travelling without a ticket over 100 times. Charles Brahiri was banned from entering any Thameslink station as part of his bail conditions in April. Westminster magistrates heard the 28-year-old, who's homeless, has been caught a further 30 times since then. He's due back there in December. And for a roundup of the news on demand, you can subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
That is who we are, and it's always good to be reminded of it by a third party at 2:04 on a weekday afternoon. Welcome to Wednesdays on Times Radio. Jane and Fee with you until 4. We are packed as ever. We're going to start with casting our eyes up to space, but unfortunately, what we won't be able to see anymore is a UK space agency because it's getting absorbed into the Department for Science and Technology. Now, is that a shame? Is it entirely sensible in a world where we can't afford the NHS? On the other hand, and it is a big hand, is it wise to leave space exploration to the billionaires? We're then going to look to Tommy Robinson and his earnings on a new platform, Minect. It's where you go if you want to pay to have a personal mentoring episode with people who believe that they have something to offer. Other names on the platform include Candace Owens and Douglas Carswell, the former MP and Vote Leave co-founder. You can ask Tommy Robinson a question for $40 and he promises to get back to you within 8 days. Also today, wanted, 3 flatmates to live in a central Rome location, must be good with robes, some disruption on a Sunday and no overnight lady visitors allowed.
Oh, for heaven's sake, you've gone too far now. Who are we talking about?
The Pope is going to share his papal flat with 3 friars and Tom Kington is going to fill us in on that. All of your TV today with Scott Bryant, and after 3:30...
we're talking to Sean Linton, who is the Sunday Times health editor, and he's back with an update on the sodium valproate scandal. It's something that people really should know about, and I know it has been reported on over many, many years now, not least by the Sunday Times, but thousands of people, particularly thousands of children, impacted by this anti-epilepsy drug taken by some women during pregnancy. And we also know that the Henrietta Hughes, forgive me, I've just lost her title here. It's very important that we get this right. She is the Patient Safety Commissioner for England. And she has said that compensation is due here. And she said that 18 months ago and they haven't had any yet. And there just doesn't seem to be any movement. To be fair, lots of MPs have raised the issue in Parliament and still nothing happens. And as Sean is really keen to point out, the parents and carers of these young people are getting older and frailer, as we all do as we age, and their children are getting bigger. In some cases, you've got teenage boys that, you know, it's women and older men cannot lift these children anymore. It's just not easy to get them about. There are other kinds of impacts. Some of these young people have autism, learning difficulties, and their lives are just tough, and the lives of their families are tough as well. And for some reason, unlike other scandals, infected blood, I guess, is one. The post office is another. Sodium valproate just hasn't quite cut through. In part, I guess, because there are so many people involved, it's quite hard to get a handle on it. I can't really explain why it's not something that we're all talking about on a daily basis, but the fact remains that we're not. Sean, though, is very committed to keeping it in the headlines, or attempting to do so, which is why we're speaking to him again this afternoon after 3:30.
Any thoughts on anything that we're talking about today? We do love to hear from you. We are on 0333 003 2353, and if you want to send us an email, we're janeandfee@times.radio. The most read stories on the Times today, Jane.
Yeah, let's have a look at what is attracting your attention today. At number 3, I kissed a mum and I liked it. Lust, sex and the school run. I've read that completely, you know, totally bland way. Did you like it? Shall I do it again?
I think you could go and do it in a slightly more tabloid voice.
I kissed a mum and I liked it. Lust, sex and the school run. This is a story that the Times is carrying of steamy lesbian romances by an anonymous writer, newly single and absolutely fed up to the back teeth with men. It's only currently at number 3 in the most read stories on the Times website. Don't know why.
Still time.
At number 2, well, there's no will involved, you see, or inheritance. The second most read story is scientists crack what causes sleep attacks during the day. One in five people suffers from excessive daytime sleepiness, or EDS. But new research offers hope to those with unwanted nap attacks, although it is bad news for cheese and wine lovers. Right. And the most read piece on the Times website, this is more like it, Rachel Reeves plans to tax high-value homes to plug fiscal hole. The Chancellor may use the autumn budget to end the tax exemption under plans that would be seen as a so-called mansion tax. Now, you can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. And if you don't have one, you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe.
I think worth it just for those three articles alone. We're going to start in space today. The UK Space Agency will soon cease to exist as an independent entity in order to cut bureaucracy. It's being absorbed by the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology in April next year. Let's talk to Melissa Quinn, who's Managing Director of Slingshot Aerospace UK. Hello, Melissa.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, our pleasure. What does Slingshot Aerospace do exactly?
So we track every single satellite that's in space and make sure they don't hit one another. On the kind of good side of things. On the negative side of things, we look out for dubious behavior in space. So maybe spy satellites or satellites that might be looking to take out other satellites. And we make sure that authorities know what's going on in space.
Right, what fascinating
Big Brother
work.
In space. Yeah.
Tell us your thoughts about the UK Space Agency merging with a different department. It stops it being a quango, doesn't it, and brings it into full government control. But it's hard, I think, for us civilians to work out whether or not that's a very good thing or a rather sad thing.
And I think it's the same for us in industry as well. So previous to my role at Slingshot, I ran the spaceport down in Cornwall and worked with UK Space Agency for almost 10 years to bring launch to the UK. And they were an integral part of that, mainly because they just give us that brand recognition that we are, you know, a serious spacefaring nation. If you look globally, there's more space agencies being set up, and it seems that we're kind of going the opposite direction for some reason now. I wouldn't say it was a shock to industry that the announcement overnight. We've been hearing there was going to be some changes, but I think it is sad. I think it not just for our colleagues that work in the UK Space Agency, who are experts, technical experts in their field of space, which is very rare still in this day and age to have those experts around and wanting to be, you know, really helpful to us in industry. So it remains to be seen, really, of how this is really going to benefit outside of maybe just saving some efficiencies and some money. But it's for us in the industry, it's been a bit of a shock and a bit upsetting.
Does it save money in the long term, though? Sir Chris Bryant, Space Minister, said that the UK reap returns of £5 to £6 for every £1 invested in the space sector.
Yeah, it's a booming industry. We think of just like Elon Musk and SpaceX, but actually outside of that, there's so much going on. I think in the UK, it's worth $19 billion to the economy, which is growing every single year. You know, there's over 50,000 people employed in it, all with really well-paying salaries. So it's a really exciting industry. And the UK do have a foothold globally in some parts of this industry. So I do think trying to cut money now from some of the programs that UK Space Agency are putting out, they haven't said exactly what they are going to cut. And so that's one thing that industry have already been asking for is they say they want to save money, but we don't know where that's going to come from and what impact that's actually going to have on this momentum that we've been building over the last 15 years since the UK Space Agency was created.
When you say, Melissa, that we have a decent foothold in the space industry, what does that actually mean? What do we do?
So again, my previous life of launching satellites to space, right now, the UK are one of the largest manufacturers of small satellites. And every single one of those gets shipped overseas to launch. And that's why launch was so important to create here in the UK, to capture our own market, really, to launch our own satellites to space. So that's one area, exploration. There's some huge programs right now, really exciting things going on with exploring out beyond the moon and Mars. that the UK have always had a bit of a prowess in. And then on the slightly boring side to a lot of people, but really important to the industry, is regulations and law and insurance in space. It helps keeps it safe. And with Slingshot, we can see, you know, the growth of space debris and space junk and the carelessness maybe that humans have had over the last 50 years of just dumping things in space and not thinking about the future and the sustainability of our orbits. They impact our daily lives here. And we also have part ownership in the UK Space Agency, part ownership in things like OneWeb to provide our satellite communications. So a lot in the UK that is going on. We're one of the major players in the space industry globally. And I do hope that this doesn't have a negative impact.
Do you think that we are going to make ourselves vulnerable to bad actors if we don't keep up our investment in the space business now?
I'm very biased in this, of course, for where I work, but we do see on a daily basis the massive risk that's happening in space. And I could scare a lot of people quite quickly with what we are seeing.
Actually, Melissa, because I think it's one of those subjects we just don't talk enough about. So please feel free to scare us.
Okay. On one side, you know, thousands of satellites are being launched every year, but none of them are being, you know, retrieved or deorbited, which means you're getting huge amounts of congestion in space. And any collision that could happen in space would wipe out other satellites and make it unusable potentially for up to, you know, decades at a time. And we are so disconnected from space here on Earth and in our mentality. But anytime you're using GPS, getting money, transferred to emergency services, use it every single day, it could have a really negative impact. And then on the much scarier side, we have, you know, the militarization of space that we are seeing. And we do think that space will become the next warfighting domain. It's happening now. Whether that's nuclear weapons in space, whether it's, as I said, spy satellites or our adversaries potentially taking one of our very important communication satellites out of space. It is scary stuff. And I think opening politicians' eyes to the fact that this is a real risk for everybody in our country, all of our assets in space are at risk. So continuing to ensure that we're protecting space for just our future, for the good things, but also to avoid, you know, our adversaries getting more and more strong in space is really important for everybody.
And do you think, just on that point, that it is possible to curb the aggressive ambitions of other states in space? We can't control them on this planet, can we?
Yeah, I wish humans, you know, have learned from our past, whether it's, you know, the plastic pollution we're seeing in our oceans and very similar to the debris we're seeing in space to, yeah, this new warfighting domain. I think the only thing with space that I would say is we're kind of all in it together. If one country messes it up for somebody else, they actually are messing it up for themselves as well, because it will make it unusable for their own country. So I do think there's a bit more diplomacy that we can do in space. I think there's a bit of saber rattling, as we like to say in the industry. We love a cliche saying in the industry, but
yes, it's, so do we in journalism, actually, Melissa, so absolutely go for it.
Any puns, we're good. We're good at the space industry. So I think, you know, I think there is some room for diplomacy because we are kind of, it is everybody's at the minute to use. And we've shown in the past, whether it's astronauts on the ISS from all different countries, you know, including Russia, like we do work together really well in space. But unfortunately, there's a few that are trying to kind of show their strength in outer space as well as here on Earth. And we just got to make sure that we're ready to respond to that if we have to.
Who are the ones who are trying to show their muscle?
We Slingshot last summer, we tracked a Russian spacecraft that was, moving in bizarre ways. And we actually used AI to predict that it was going to locate itself next to a very important UK satellite communications satellite, and that was supporting the forces in Ukraine, for instance. So we know that Russia have been kind of flexing their muscles. They've done things in the past, like take out their own satellite, which created a huge cloud of debris. It's called anti-satellite testing. It's not good. And then more recently, we've seen China do things like launch a spacecraft where they might say it's to an environmental purpose, but then we can see with our telescopes that it might release a secondary spacecraft that nobody knows what it's going to do.
Wow.
So there's a lot of questions going on at the minute, but it's all out there and publicized. So hopefully that transparency will keep everybody in check.
Sure. And you say it's out there and publicized, but I don't think we're talking about this enough. And you in your daily work are looking at things that could affect the future of the planet. Do you find it frustrating? Maybe you go to the pub of an evening and people are moaning about the fact there's nothing on Netflix and you're just like, oh my goodness, you know, understand the perspective here.
Yeah. And again, my time at Spaceport, where I had people saying, why would we spend money on launching to space when there's so many of these social issues and environmental and economic issues here on Earth? And I absolutely understand that. But without space, it's really hard to, you know, solve some of those challenges. And then from an outreach perspective, getting kids excited about careers in STEM, we use that through space. And again, tying it back to UK Space Agency, they were a great voice for the industry. They were a great place for public engagement to be able to express some of these things that are going on that in most people's day-to-day lives, they don't even think of, or they dismiss it as just like, oh, billionaires going to space from time to time. But the reality is we all fundamentally rely on space every single day. I think each of us, I heard the research coming out of places like UK Space Agency, we each use space at least 20 times in our day, every single person. So we are reliant on it. And I think there's that dissociation between it that is scary and frustrating for us in the industry to try and communicate. But that's why we need, you know, better storytellers, and not just the space geeks, who I do love, but they don't maybe do the best job of communicating outside of their own bubbles. And it's really important that we get, you know, more creatives involved in this industry to tell these stories.
Yeah. Well, we'll have you on our programme anytime, Melissa. Thank you very much indeed. Really fascinating stuff. Melissa Quinn is the Managing Director of Slingshot Aerospace UK. And let's just hold on to that fact, Jane, that we are using space 20 times a day, but most of us really couldn't tell you how, who's up there, what the problems are, what the politics are. It's quite strange, isn't it?
Yeah, she's right about the space geeks potentially maybe just sort of hogging the environment, the space, when in fact it should be something that all of us talk about all the time and acknowledge the significance of the amazing advances that some brilliant people have made. But it was also quite frightening, that interview. But thank you for bringing it to us. Things aren't getting any cozier next, really, here on Times Radio. We're asking whether Tommy Robinson's advice is really worth £28 a minute. We'll attempt to assess that shortly. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio, 21 minutes past two.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio. Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening. Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Tesco Finest Sugar Bell Tomatoes, the ultimate supporting act. Zinging up salads or elevating fresh linguine. Perfect for when you want to be vined and dined. It's why only the finest varieties are hand-picked when perfectly ripe, to ensure our Sugar Bell tomatoes are exceptionally sweet. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. on Times Radio.
A Times investigation has found that the far-right activist who calls himself Tommy Robinson is making thousands by charging up to 28 quid a minute to advise his followers. The English Defence League co-founder, his real name is Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, uses a mentoring platform to deliver paid written or video messages to followers. The Times' Shanti Das told Kate Borsay on Times Radio what these messages have focused on.
So it's on his anti-Islam activism, but also on issues like censorship, talking about his experiences with in leadership of the EDL, and speaking about things ranging from protesting to dealing with security services when you're running a group, and also giving words of encouragement to people who are involved in anti-Islam activism themselves. So in some cases, you know, giving tips on how to get engagement on social media or to investigate local mosques, things like that.
That's the Times journalist Shanti Das. Well, Robinson hasn't responded to requests for comment from the Times, but he did post on social media that he would not be cancelled. Let's have a word with Sid Venkatarama Krishnan, who's an analyst at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Sid, good afternoon. Quickly, what is the Institute for Strategic Dialogue?
Good afternoon. Lovely to be on. We're a think tank working on research around hate, misinformation and information operations and extremist propaganda online.
OK. Have you seen much of this interaction between Tommy Robinson and his followers? What do you think of it?
I think it's interesting because what we've traditionally seen is that, you know, we've seen Tommy Robinson as maybe one of those examples who really stands out in having large public following, so at rallies, whether that's EDL or sort of more recently in other groups or other settings. I think the switch to a sort of Patreon-like model, Patreon being a platform where people can, Cameo-like model where people can pay, usually celebrities, to have a short message delivered is very interesting. I think there's a lot of, cynically I'd say that the main focus is on making money, but there is obviously the danger that people who are perhaps already feeling aggrieved or disfranchised feel more motivated to take part in action because of having this direct or seemingly direct connection.
Yes, and there is no doubt that we all want to be seen and heard and to be acknowledged, to have your existence acknowledged by somebody you admire is quite significant, isn't it?
It is. I think that there is, in some ways, the danger or the potential danger comes from a sense of that that I've been chosen as opposed to sort of tactics. I think that obviously there are some tactics being discussed around sort of how to avoid being cancelled or how to grow your following and things like that. But for me, my great concern is that people feel they are chosen in a sense and then sort of move from there into potentially taking action.
Yeah. But what do you make of his tone in these messages? Can I just read? Here's a question, actually, from somebody who was prepared to pay to get advice from him. This individual is actually an undercover reporter for The Times who asked, "There's a migrant hotel in my town 5 minutes away from me. Do you think it is worth taking action on a local level?" To which Robinson replies, "Mate, I currently think it's brilliant what all the protests outside the hotels and the fact there's so many women and ordinary people." This is verbatim. "And I think it's brilliant the fact it's not coordinated by anyone like me, so they can't tarnish it." What do you say to that?
I think it's very much in line with Robinson's messaging generally. And actually what we've seen is the fact that Robinson has been a very visible figure and, you know, linked to you know, sort of not necessarily great acts in the past, as well as, you know, leaving country. In a way, his efforts to position himself as outside of it or the protests targeting migrant hotels are sort of seen as grassroots and organic is quite a slick move, I think, PR-wise, and to sort of position it as saying, you know, it's not me doing it, but, you know, if you're doing it, that's great. It's quite clever in terms of making it seem like he's supportive whilst at the same time giving himself plausible deniability.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we do know that there are genuinely some people in towns who are concerned about the migrant hotels. They don't like the idea that some of these people, about whom we know next to nothing, well, nothing in most cases, are resident in hotels and potentially may pose a threat to some vulnerable members of the local community. That's quite legitimate. What isn't legitimate is the far-right activists who are, what do you think, increasingly embedding themselves amongst them?
I think that we've seen a switch over the last 5 or 10 years from discussions targeting Muslims in particular. And if you look at the EDL, the English Defence League, that was a specifically anti-Islamisation, in their words, group, which has now shifted increasingly, you know, the discourse has shifted to talking about migrants generally. So I think it's sort of concurrent that you have good faith or genuine protests about migrant hotels and about, you know, questions around who is in them coming from local residents, whilst at the same time you have an embedded infrastructure of far-right actors who have been pivoting to attacking migrants as a generalised category, meaning basically non-white migrants, particularly from Africa or South Asia, who are seen as a whole as a threatening sort of homogenous blob, essentially. So I think it has become more vocal and more evident now, but it has been a sort of long-term shift.
Right. And of course, some of those people will be celebrating the events of yesterday.
Yes, the council.
Yeah.
I think it is a obviously a significant symbolic move. There's more to happen, play out, but I think it certainly has validated in the public arena, seemingly the arguments from far right actors that, you know, if these actions are seen as much more grassroots or organic, then I think they have a much greater chance of success. You can compare it to last year and the attacks, you know, the attempts to burn down the migrant hotels.
Just a quick word on the platform that this man, Robinson, is using. It's American, isn't it? I mean, which indicates that there is quite a significant US influence here. Do you think we should be concerned about that?
I suppose, if we look at the far right now, it is increasingly transnational. And that is, that's just a fact of the situation we're in now. I think that, you know, Tommy Robinson has friends in America, you know, has collaborated on podcasts with American anti-migrant actors. I think it is, I mean, the situation we're in now is that voices in the US are quite happy to have people like Tommy Robinson to inject them into the debate. And it sort of plays out on both sides. You know, if you can say, look, the UK is being overrun by migrants, it supports your allies in the UK, whilst at the same time, if you're in the US or Australia or any other country, you can import that discourse back and say, if we don't want that to happen to us, we need to take strong action like mass deportations.
Just can I put a point to you from a listener who just says, why do you persist in calling him Tommy Robinson when it's not his name? It's all the media, he says. I mean, what do you think about that, Sid? What should we do? I mean, Ali, who's WhatsApped, is perfectly right. It's not his name. I have said what his real name is. Why don't we just use his real name?
It's a very fair point. I'm trying to think of other sort of famous nom de guerre, which are used in common parlance. I think media coverage of him has varied. I know, I think there have been some cases where I've seen Yaxley Lennon being used consistently throughout. I suppose it's useful in the sense of identifying who we're talking about
by using it, we're kind of buying into the brand, aren't we?
Yes, that I can see that point, but I it's a fair point. I suppose there's, on the one side, you could say you're buying the brand. On the other side, I think the Robinson brand is a curious one in that elements of the far right see him as being one, too Israeli, and two, you know, not far enough, not anti-migrant enough, and that he has quite a large following from Hindu nationalists and has sort of collaborated with them. I think Robinson's an interesting figure in that he is sort of reviled by quite a lot of people, even though he has a lot of supporters. I'm not sure whether that means we should change to using Yaxley Lennon or whether that would actually impact him, though.
Right. Thank you very much for giving us your time. We appreciate it. Sid Venkatarama Krishnan, who is from the Institute for Strategic Dialogue.
So the only other person I can think of is Gary Glitter, and we did stop saying Gary Glitter, long time ago.
Yeah, I'd be interested in what people think about that. And thanks to Ali for sending that message in. You are, of course, very welcome to do exactly that.
Yep. I'm not making a direct comparison there before anybody gets upset with me. This one comes in from Bradley. Imagine having personal advice from Jane and Fee for £28 a minute. Let's dwell on that for a second, Bradley. who goes on to say it would be like having two mother figures.
Oh.
I'm happy to
be. We don't know how
maternal.
Old. Yes, okay.
Very happy. Yeah. And to be honest, we'll just answer people's queries for free.
No, we won't.
I'm so sorry. No, we won't.
Those
Bradley.
Days are over.
Coming up, what sort of housemate will the new Pope make? Do you think he pulls his weight when it comes to cleaning? All of that and your telly with Scott Bryan and tennis from the US Open with Lisa O'Sullivan. Jane's just having a beer there. That's the sound you can hear. Let's get the latest news first with Martin Williams.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. There could be further legal challenges over asylum hotels after a council in Essex was granted an injunction blocking migrants from being housed in Epping. It was one on planning laws following weeks of protests. A migrant who was staying at the Bell is accused of sexual assault, which he denies. All residents must leave by the 12th of September. The Security Minister Dan Jarvis has given his reaction to Times Radio.
We're looking very carefully at a specific legal judgment that took place yesterday. We will ensure that appropriate arrangements are put in place for those people required to move from the hotel in Epping. We've consistently said that hotels are not appropriate accommodation for asylum seekers, and we are very significantly increasing the rate at which we are making asylum decisions.
The Conservatives say families are paying for economic mismanagement after inflation hit its highest level since January. The rate of 3.8% has been driven by summer demand for airfares and the rising cost of food. A murder inquiry is underway after a 38-year-old man was stabbed to death near Wembley Stadium. Two people have been arrested. Israel's military has confirmed it'll call up 60,000 reservists as part of a renewed offensive in Gaza. The plan to move further into the territory has been heavily criticised by world leaders and many politicians in Israel. And Vienna is to host next year's Eurovision Song Contest. The capital's been chosen after Austria's entry JJ won this year's competition. And you can hear detailed analysis of the biggest developments in global security in our World in 10 podcast.
This is Times Radio.
Direct Line's flexible business cover means I only pay for the cover I need. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like dominating the pub quiz.
Final question. What is the population of Mongolia?
3,537,947.
It's absolutely correct. This week's winner is none of your quizness.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
I kissed a mop and I liked it. And I liked it. Lust, sex and the school run. Yeah, I knew that was coming. Pathetic. I'm considering my position. Get on with it. Times Radio Drive with John Pienaar from 4 until 7. So your production team doesn't humiliate you in the same kind of way, does it, John?
No, I bet
ultimate
doesn't.
Respect, it doesn't, Ryan. Yeah. Hang your head
nor is
shame.
Yours, he said, currying favour with the team across the room. Yeah. And my team have done the business definitely today. So the row about asylum seeking, accommodation, asylum seekers accommodation, it's such a huge story, isn't it? And the government, if it's in a tight corner, it's going to get tighter very, very quickly. I'm going to be talking to, among others, the leader of the council in Dudley, which it seems, I'm told, is getting ready to be the next in line to go to the court and try to put a bar on asylum seekers using a hotel in that town. And they'll just be the first, but we'll talk to the council leader there about what's driven that. There were protests at the weekend, and some of those on the local councils are saying, yes, there are, and that's a problem, but it's not just that. It's also people who don't protest and turn up with St. George's flags and so on. They come up quietly and say they're worried, and genuinely worried. And how does a local council completely ignore that? They simply can't. So there are lots of layers to the motives in all of this. At one level, political cynicism, at another concern, at another we're talking about a certain kind of hatred, at another a certain kind of worry that it's not difficult to understand. And it adds up to a really difficult problem for the government. So we'll have the local councillor on. I'll be talking to Max Kendricks about the options as and when councils cease to be available, and to Enver Solomon from the Refugee Council, just to give the point of view from the refugees' perspective and those who are defending them. Also, I'm going to be talking about the coalition of the willing talks. I think just to use that phrase now, it's self-explanatory. It's about putting together a force to guard the peace in Ukraine. And so far, all there is to say about those talks is they don't seem to be producing anything concrete, and I'm not sure how that's going to change. And later, I'm going to be talking to the head of Impressionist and Modern Art at Sotheby's, because they're about to have a huge sale of incredibly impressive and very valuable pieces. But this is a part of a series where I talk to people from Sotheby's, all of them doing something in the field in which they are, all of them, passionately, emotionally engaged. And it's one of the more interesting conversations I have all week.
We get obsessed with the money, don't we, when it comes
to
the art?
Do. Yep. We always do. But their passion is what sort of gets you.
Yes, no, it'd be nice to hear the passion, not just the £60 million.
Yes, yes, it would.
Yes.
Money isn't everything. Paul says, good afternoon. Regarding Tommy Robinson, I don't particularly like him and wouldn't pay for his advice, but he's not the first person to change his name or use a pseudonym and be known by it. And from Matt, my name is Matt Robinson. I'll be creating a group to stop this repulsive character using our good surname. I'll call it the Robinsons against Tommy Robinson using the surname.
It's catchy.
Well, yes, it needs work, but I actually can see your point. It must be infuriating. I mean, that is genuinely Matt's name. It isn't what's its name, is it? He's just pretending. Oh, honestly, the world. What would it be like to live with the Pope? A question, let's be honest, very few of us have actually asked ourselves. But 3 months after his election as the first ever American pontiff, Louis XIV is said to be planning to turn the Vatican's papal apartment into something of a flat share. Now, Tom Kington is a favourite here on our programme. He writes for The Times in Rome. Tom, lovely to talk to you again. So what are these fairly extraordinary arrangements that the Pope is planning?
Well, the papal apartment, which is in the Apostolic Palace at the Vatican, and we can picture it because it's where the Pope emerges from his window to wave at the crowd in St. Peter's, so you know where it is.
Yeah.
And famously, Pope Leo's predecessor, Pope Francis, didn't live there. He chose to live in a busy residence elsewhere in the Vatican because he was a man of the people kind of thing going on there. And so for 12 years, this papal apartment lay empty. Now, Pope Leo, he was elected 3 months ago, but he's still not moved in. We think he's going to move in, but there's been a bit of a mystery as to why he hasn't. And one explanation, not confirmed yet, could be that he's having a bit of work done and he's divvying the apartment up into sort of sub-apartments because he'd like to have some people move in with him and sort of end the kind of isolation that popes often live in up there. So people are asking, well, why? And the reason is because Pope Leo is from the Augustinian religious order. So these are friars. This is what he did before he was pope. And they always live in communities. That you have groups of friars who live together. So this is a pope who's very much used to living in a community. It's the sort of, the Augustinians have described it as being the sort of the essence of their creed. They get together, they talk with each other, they lean on each other for support, they trust each other. It sounds great, actually. And so what people are saying he might do now is move a kind of gang of fellow friars into the apartment with him so he can continue to have that support network. The apartment is big enough. I think it's about 10 rooms, so they can easily squeeze a few more friars in.
Yes. Now, they are reported to be the leading candidates for these flat-sharing roles, an Italian, a Filipino and a Nigerian, and they manage the papal wardrobe. Does it really take three men to manage another man's robes?
I think it's a bit more than that. I mean, you know, it's a lot of robes, but it's not just that. I think it's a sort of ceremonial role. So if you know, they might say, OK, we're going to need 200 seats freed up in St. Peter's for something we're doing, a mass we're doing tomorrow. Or we're going to need, we need a new mitre fast. Go out and get one. Or, you know, 300 candles yesterday. It's that kind of thing. So it's not just getting his shoes out in the morning.
Right, OK. I understand as well there had been an issue with damp in the apartment because it had been uninhabited and, frankly, unloved for so long. And no one likes damp, do they? It's horrible.
Well, I don't know what you do about that. Perhaps a lick of paint, but that's not going to cure it. So perhaps I just need to turn the heating on.
Yes, I mean, there's also that, although you probably don't need it in Rome in the summer. Some of the readers who've responded to your article on thetimes.com haven't taken it entirely seriously. I mean, one woman has put, "I just hope he puts his name on the yoghurt." I mean, there is that kind of, there is a comic element to this, isn't there? The whole idea of this incredibly important, significant man flat sharing. And then someone else, of course, has gone down the fatuous route and just written, "I hope they chip in." What with them being friars and all. But this is a serious issue. And I guess if he's a man who simply takes comfort in the companionship of others, then he's doing the right thing because this is a difficult role he has to fulfil.
Yeah. One Augustinian I spoke to yesterday, I interviewed in the piece, said he would be able to share sort of confidences with his flatmates and be sure that what he said wouldn't go further. So, and I think that's important. You know, if you get home from the office, it's been a tough day being the Pope, and you want to go home and say, "Oh my God, Cardinal this, that, or the other is such a pain in the neck," and you need to say it to someone to just get it off. Relieve the tension a bit. It'd be great to have Friar Giovanni making you a cup of tea, and you know that he's one of your own, so he's not going to go to the papers and say that.
Okay, well, let's hope he doesn't. Is that person you reference real, or is that a figment of your papal imagination, Tom?
I just made that up.
You conjured that one up. Okay. When this Pope was elected, I suppose because he was American, I made the assumption that he'd be properly outspoken on international affairs. Now, I could be wrong, but he doesn't seem to have been. Have I simply missed it, or is he still finding his papal feet?
Well, he's certainly spoken out about things, situations like Gaza. He's been very big on that. What I think he's lacking is the ability to create sound bites that his predecessor Pope Francis had. So Pope Francis would sometimes make huge gaffes, or at least would say something memorable, something really kind of out there. And Pope Leo, I think, has deliberately decided that he's not going to be like that. He can be outspoken, and I think he will increasingly be outspoken this autumn as he sort of finds his feet and starts to publish his first papal documents. But certainly what he's not got is that kind of, soundbite-friendly manner that Pope Francis had. So, for example, when Pope Francis would come back from papal trips and he'd have his normal press conference on the plane on the way back with all the journalists, he'd always come out with something really, really quotable. And I think that Pope Leo, despite the fact that he's American, he's younger, I think that he's decided he's not going to rock the boat like that.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed. Tom Kington, who knows, perhaps when he's settled with the flatmates, he'll be a little more out there with what he says and does.
Becky, thank you for your message. On Virgin Radio earlier, they referred to the Pope's new gaffe as the Big Father House. Coming up, how did it all go wrong for Emma Raducanu and Carlos Alcaraz? We'll talk to the fabulous Lisa O'Sullivan about the US Open. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. It's 3:15.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, Times Radio connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines. Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis and insight with Times Radio's daily dedicated business bulletin. Early breakfast, every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon. Your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
By river, ocean and expedition, you can now explore all seven continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, we all had high hopes for the pairing of Carlos Alcaraz and Emma Raducanu in mixed doubles at the US Open, and they gave us 50 minutes of hopage, but it never got that high because they lost their match to Jack Draper and Jessica Pegula 4-2, 4-2. Let's talk to the wonderful Lisa O'Sullivan, our tennis correspondent, back to tell us more. Hello, Lisa.
Afternoon. How are we doing?
Yeah, we're doing very well. So let's just start with that scoreline because it tells us something quite interesting about the mixed doubles and what's been going on with it. 4-2, 4-2 is not a normal tennis score, is it?
No, it's not, because they are playing what's called the fast four format. And this is something that we got to blame the Australians for back in 2015. It was a format that was introduced to basically make exhibition matches more interesting so that you could get through the sets quicker. There's no advantage, so if you go to deuce, the next point will win the game. And the whole point is about, the words that I've seen written about it is it makes the game more exciting. It just makes it quicker. There's less stress on the players if you get into a match where you've got advantage deuce, it's, you know, potentially it elongates the length of time on court. And so, yeah, first to four, three sets, and if it goes to one set apiece, that third set is a first to 10 tiebreak.
Right.
So, yeah, you won't be on court for very long.
Is it good to watch? If you've got your mind trained on the more kind of classic tennis, is it more exciting?
I really wanted to hate it because I really feel sorry for the professional tennis players who are missing out on this, and the fact that it's a Grand Slam competition. It's been given Grand Slam status, but the 16 pairs that are playing have been selected. So we've kind of gone back to the pre-open era situation where they choose who they want to play, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the best double players are there taking the mixed open competition seriously. But it is. It's really good fun. It's fun. It's fast. and it's great to people watch as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, Emma Raducanu and Carlos Alcaraz, you know, watching their chemistry is great fun. Jack Draper on the other side as well with Jessica Pegula. Yeah, it's fun. It's fast. But the problem is you're not seeing the best doubles players playing. And when you do see players like Sara Errani and her partner, Andrea Vavasori, who won the title play, they're taking no prisoners. So they're absolutely just demolishing the opposition, which you get that whole kind of one-sided match where you go, oh, okay, yeah, they absolutely thump them.
Do you know what? Becky has raised exactly that point, and she said in a text to us, can you ask Lisa whether the star players in the mixed doubles give a monkeys about winning? It all looked very hit and giggle when I watched it last night. And for that reason, I am backing the defending champions who you've just mentioned there, Lisa. It's an interesting point to make, isn't it? Did you feel that they were really invested, or is it a kind of, I'm here for the show, we're all in it together, but, you know, I'm not really sincere?
There's definitely a very wide range of attitudes on that court. I think Jack Draper and Jessica Pegula, who are the number one seeds, are in it to win it. And that's probably not because of the mixed doubles element. For Jack Draper, it's about time on court because he's been injured and he hasn't played a lot in the build-up to this US Open. So for him, this competition's actually pretty handy, and playing a bit of doubles really, you know, can sharpen up your network. You've got a good opportunity to work on your serve under less pressure than you would be in a game situation, but it is a match situation. But there are definitely players that were just turning up and thought, this is a bit of a laugh. And I'm not saying that about Raducanu and Alcaraz, but they're not doubles players. And so when you meet two players that are gelled really well, that are thumping you. You know, as you say, 50 minutes, you're not going to be on court long. Smile, wave at the crowd. It is such an exhibition match. Everybody is watching things they don't normally watch in the tennis. They're not watching the tennis. They're watching how the players are getting on with each other. You know, there's a DJ set of the crowds dancing. It's far more. And I don't even think you can liken it to 2020 in cricket and test cricket, because 2020 is taken seriously. But this, it's being taken seriously by some, definitely by the defending champions, because there's $1 million up for grabs. And when they won the title last year, they only won $200,000. They've already banked that by making it through to the semi-finals. If they make it to the final, they're guaranteed $400,000. So they're double the money that they won last year. So yeah, they're definitely doing it. But no, there are players that were just waving. I mean, put it this way, Jack Draper is playing with Jessica Pegula, but she's actually his third partner, because Zhang Xinwen and Paula Badosa had to withdraw injured. So it kind of makes a mockery of those names that are going to be on the trophy who won the mixed doubles in previous years.
Okay. Well, we delight in your honesty at all times. And I mean, I take on board everything you're saying, Lisa, but actually, you know, if you are going to just in really enjoy watching it, know what you're watching, know all of that behind the scenes, then it's a good thing for tennis, isn't it? It just means more people will join in. It might be the gateway drug to the longer games.
Absolutely, absolutely. And bringing it into the week before the US Open is sticking the headlines firmly in New York and at Flushing Meadows, where they're getting ready. We'll have the draw tomorrow. We'll find out who everybody's playing. And from that point of view, it's brilliant. But I think the problem I have with it, you shouldn't get a Grand Slam title for winning four games and, you know, playing. You could play just eight sets or whatever and win it. I think they could have this competition at the beginning, but don't give it a Grand Slam status, because that makes a mockery of the mixed doubles players who specialise in it. And I know there's not a huge number of players that do that, but there are some brilliant doubles tennis players out there who are looking to get their name on the trophy, but they don't get a chance here because they didn't get a wild card, because that's not how the organisers wanted it to pan out.
Yeah, because they're not jazz hands enough. Thank you very much indeed. Lovely to talk to you again. That's tennis reporter Lisa O'Sullivan.
Let's talk television now in the company of the country's leading TV critic, Scott Bryan. So, autumn is almost upon us. That means big budget drama is back, and one that actually becomes available tomorrow is Netflix's Hostage. It stars Shiran Jones as the British Prime Minister. Her husband's been kidnapped, and she has to work alongside the French President, played by Julie Delpy, who's facing some threats of her own. Here's a clip.
Today, the Prime Minister begins this critical summit with President Toussaint.
You want us to better police our borders?
No.
I want to police them for you.
You can't allow the French to dictate terms.
You were meant to be the politician people could trust.
Nothing will distract me.
Prime Minister, your husband has been abducted.
Well, it sounds like a pretty tough day at the office for the British Prime Minister, played by Shiran Jones in Hostage. Here is Scott. Is this any good, Scott? I keep seeing trailers. I keep being sent emails about it. Is it any cop?
Well, I can't reveal all of the details because there is an embargo, but I would say that it's certainly trying to do the suspenseful thing of making you kind of... I think Netflix is trying to tap into suspenseful TV viewing in the same way, of course, Bodyguard was a massive hit for the BBC. I think, was it back in 2018, 2017, when that became a national sensation? And there's eerie similarities between this in terms of the setup, in terms of the high-stakes drama, and also in terms of not really knowing how it's all going to play out and whether the people are going to survive. You know, normally these shows can feel quite conventional, but I think they've really kind of upped the octave. And I think it's just the fact that Netflix are spending a lot more on British drama. Sometimes it can be a little bit silly. Sometimes it can be, you know, really rather serious, of course, with Adolescence being such a big mainstream hit. It's going to be wondering, like, sometimes I think if a show like this, this new Shiran Jones drama, was on the BBC, would it have more viewers than it would have on Netflix? Because sometimes I think that all of us just like watching a BBC show, like a high stakes thriller, because you know that everyone else is watching it at the same time. Mm. It's that kind of national conversation. So it'll be interesting to see how this lands.
Yeah, I know. I'll be watching it. It's definitely drawn me in. Something on the BBC is King and Conqueror. Now, this is about Harold and William the Conqueror. And James Norton, who's on Times Radio Tomorrow with Hugo Rifkin, plays, well, actually, he plays Harold, which I was quite surprised by.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that I think is trying to sort of state itself as the big sort of drama for the autumn, because it's pretty much this weekend that the BBC are sort of showing off their wares. I mean, I think it's also interesting because there is a kind of a historical context from it, but of course, I think it then sort of takes some liberties. But I think that's all in part of the nature of it. I think it's also the fact that this is a really, really big production, which is fewer and further between than what you would normally see on TV these days, particularly on the BBC, just because the cost of drama is substantially up. But then the risk is a little bit higher, because if it doesn't kind of connect with a large viewership, it can end up being quite costly. So I think the BBC are banking this to be a success starting this Sunday evening. Whether it will, we'll have to wait and see.
Yep. OK. And let's also have a word about Riot Women. This is by Sally Wainwright. And once again, she set the drama in Hebden Bridge. And is this about a band? I think I've read a bit about this.
It is about sort of five women who decide to launch a punk rock band. I think from the premise alone, I would be normally with a bit of scepticism. But I mean, this is Sally Wainwright, and Sally Wainwright is one of the great writers of this sort of century, I'd say, like in terms of TV. She has a way, of course, of sort of cutting through and providing something that's incredibly human and also unique. I mean, Happy Valley, to have the ratings that it had, I think also a show that had a gap of like 8 or 9 years and then was still able to tie up loose ends and have that perfect sort of series three finale. I think the expectation is that she'll sort of strike gold again with this new BBC series. But also at the same time, she had a Disney Plus series that sadly just didn't connect with an audience, even though I felt it had fantastic performances and great sort of storylines there. I mean, I think that might have been because of the fact that it was on Disney rather than on the BBC. So yet again, I think hopefully a lot of people will be talking about it, but I can't review it because there's not even in preview yet of that. It's still wait and see.
Well, I think, honestly, all the dramas we've discussed today, I'm pretty certain I'll watch all of them. So we were discussing there. Thank you very much, Scott. We were discussing Riot Women. That's the new Sally Wainwright coming your way in October. And then starting this weekend, King and Conqueror with Hugo Rifkin tomorrow, talking to one of the stars, James Norton on Times Radio, and then Hostage on Netflix with Suran Jones as the Prime Minister, beleaguered Prime Minister. That starts on Netflix tomorrow.
And Nick says, at least when she was busy, this is Suran Jones in Hostage, somebody took her husband off her hands. Now, Nick, you're almost as cynical as us there.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. British troops stand ready to defend Ukraine's seas and skies, but may not be deployed to the front lines. As commanders of the Coalition of the Willing meet, we're going to hear what they need to succeed from one former peacekeeper. Donald Trump's meant to be banning TikTok. Instead, he's joining us. More on that from Chris Stokel-Walker. The Sunday Times' health editor is our big interview after 3:30 on the children abandoned after the sodium valproate scandal. And why does a rogue dolphin potentially pose a risk to swimmers in Dorset? We have the answers. Are you sure we have the answers? We'll try anyway. First, it's Martin Williams with the headlines.
Thank you. Good afternoon. At least a dozen councils across England are considering challenging asylum seekers being housed in hotels in their areas. The High Court granted Epping Forest Council a temporary injunction to block asylum seekers from being housed at the Bell. Times Radio political correspondent Theo Usherwood says it's a huge headache for the Home Office.
Because, of course, British law is based on precedent, and the precedent now is, in this case, the High Court agreed with the council, the council in Epping, that by this switching to a house asylum seekers, that amounted to a change in use. As a result of agreeing to this, if there are further cases, they can point to this case and they would expect to win.
A bigger than expected rise in inflation last month could be bad news for homeowners with variable mortgages. Figures show the rate at which prices are rising went up to 3.8% in July from 3.6% and could mean cuts to borrowing costs are paused. An earlier than usual jump in summer airfares is being blamed. Rachel Reeves is set to be drawing up plans to hit the owners of high-value properties with capital gains tax when they sell their homes. It's part of an attempt to bridge a £40 billion hole in the public finances. It could mean some homeowners being hit with a bill of almost £200,000 if the property threshold was set at £1.5 million. Housing expert Henry Pryor has told Times Radio it'd be a major reversal in policy.
We have historically been exempt from capital gains tax on any increase in the value of your principal residence, your private home. And that being the case, the Treasury forgoes a whopping £28 billion a year. It's the biggest tax giveaway, along with VAT exemption on food and children's clothing, for example.
A man from Buckinghamshire who stabbed a man in his 60s before shooting a police officer with a crossbow has been sentenced to 9 years in prison. Jason King admitted attacking his neighbour, then firing at the officer during a standoff in High Wycombe in May last year. The 54-year-old, who has a history of mental health issues, admitted offences including GBH and possession of an offensive weapon. And it's understood NATO defence chiefs are holding a meeting to discuss possible future security guarantees for Ukraine that could help forge a peace agreement. President Trump's ruling out putting US boots on the ground if a deal's done with Moscow. Senior diplomat Sergei Lavrov warns discussing security guarantee issues without Moscow is a road to nowhere. Carlos Sanz was the US ambassador to Denmark during the first Trump administration.
NATO membership is off the table for Ukraine, but there will be security guarantees and European boots on the ground to make sure that even after territory is ceded, that Russia no longer attacks Ukraine, part of Europe. That's an important comfort.
And remember, our news podcasts are on the Times Radio app. Look for the Times News Briefing and the World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. We're here until 4 o'clock. You're very welcome to pitch in on the WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. We're talking about a very pesky dolphin after 3:30. We're also discussing sodium valproate and the so-called abandoned children who still don't have compensation after their mothers took an anti-epilepsy drug during pregnancy, and it left some of these young people, some now in their 20s and 30s, with lifelong issues, to put it very, very mildly. So Sean Linton of the Sunday Times, he's the health editor there, is talking to us about this issue after 3:30. And we'll also have the tech news with Chris Stoker-Walker today. Donald Trump is not banning TikTok. No, in fact, he's joining TikTok. Chris with all the details in around 10 minutes' time. British troops stand ready to help defend Ukraine from the skies and seas, but they aren't expected to keep the peace on the front lines. That's the message expected to be delivered to Washington today by the head of the British military, Admiral Sir Tony Radakin. The Times is reporting on the options available to the so-called Coalition of the Willing, with generals meeting virtually this afternoon. So what would any British deployment need to succeed? Let's have a word with Lieutenant General David Leakey, who's a former British Army officer. Good afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
And I know that you commanded a peacekeeping force in Bosnia. First of all, tell us what that peacekeeping force consisted of. How many different nationalities?
Oh, goodness. I think it was up to over 20 at one stage. It was really multinational, and it wasn't just Europeans either. And that was important because one of the factions, you will remember in the Bosnia situation context, was a Muslim faction. So there were troops from Muslim countries. I remember I had a Moroccan battalion under command at one stage.
Well, that sounds...
Now, there's a key difference here between Bosnia, which was 1995, the Dayton Peace Accord secured peace in Bosnia, and NATO volunteered to implement that peace, even though there was a signed agreement by all the major participants in the war there. NATO agreed to deploy a force, and the strength of that force was 40,000. Actually, it never reached 40,000 because the peace was so well consolidated after about 30,000 had deployed into Bosnia. I think they cancelled the last few thousand. But here's the point. Bosnia is a small country. The distance along the front lines between the war and factions was measured in tens of kilometres all round the war. I mean, it was maybe 250, 300 kilometres. But in Ukraine, we're talking about something quite different. The scale of this is huge. It's over 1,200 kilometres. is the division between the two factions, albeit it's focused more in certain areas, particularly in the Donbass and down near Crimea. But 40,000 troops just in Bosnia. So imagine the number of troops that would be required to do the same sort of mission if they were deployed to Ukraine. And that is unimaginable. And I don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
And just heard in the news,
yeah,
Admiral Radakin said boots won't be on the ground. I don't know whether that's... I think I caught that right from the news.
Yes. Well, I mean, you've made it very clear that if this were to take place, it would be a colossal and possibly quite impractical, verging on impossible task for any peacekeeping force. And as you said, in Bosnia, the peace, I think you described it as consolidated. There are no guarantees about a consolidated peace here at all, are there?
No, there aren't. And I think actually I have quite deliberately started at the wrong end of the telescope, if you see what I mean. I described what the operational deployment in Bosnia was, and it was some 40,000 troops that was necessary to fulfil the mission. What we need to do is to look at it from the other end of the telescope, and that starts with what is the context, what is the level of agreement between the two factions, in this case Russia and Ukraine, if they are really both committed to peace and they get a settlement, whether it's on territory or sovereignty or front lines or further talks. But if they're really committed to that, then there shouldn't be a need for a large force to, as it were, implement or safeguard that. Much more likely would be a smaller force on the ground and in the air to monitor, to make sure that both sides are honouring the ceasefire or the peace agreement in terms, and that would not require, as it were, a major deterrence or implementation presence on the ground. And I think that's one of the things we need to look at. What are the conditions for setting the mission? And the second thing is, having identified what the conditions are, is then what is the mission? And is it to act as a deterrent to Russian aggression? Is it just to monitor the ceasefire? Is it to police it? Nobody knows what policing means. It can mean anything from a very passive observation of the ceasefire to an active. And the deterrence can be done not necessarily with boots on the ground. So deterrence could be threatened by, for example, an attack, an indirect fire attack by missiles or aircraft, even fired from submarines. And as you know, President Trump deployed two submarines nearer to the Ukraine conflict recently, partly as a threat to cajole Putin to come to the table and have those talks. So there's a whole spectrum of military capability that could be deployed, yeah, to this. And it depends entirely on what the mission is going to be. And the mission depends on the conditions which are set for the ceasefire or, right, the peace agreement.
And the ceasefire peace agreement, this is cloud cuckoo land. We don't have either. Just looking at the latest news from Ukraine, 14 people have been killed by a Russian airstrike in the Sumy region. It hasn't stopped. And there's actually no sign that it's going to. Do you believe that there will be any kind of meeting between President Putin and President Zelensky in the near future?
Well, President Putin said the other night, I think during his phone call with President Trump during their multilateral meeting in Washington with Volodymyr Zelensky, Putin said that he was prepared to come to talks within the next 2 weeks. Since then, Foreign Minister Lavrov has watered that down. And this is a purely personal view, but the Russians have shown themselves ever since they invaded Crimea in 2014. They've walked back from the treaties and the agreements that they signed then. And as we've seen throughout this so-called negotiation, the Russians have been capricious and mendacious and unreliable. And so I have no confidence that there will be an agreement in the near future possible. And it would be a tremendous breakthrough. But I think it is going to require a lot more pressure. And that may be going on behind the scenes, which is what may surprise us. Because very often these talks come to fruition when a lot more backroom work has been done by the diplomats who are rolling the turf, as it were.
You must, I'm sure, still have many contacts in the British military. Is there confidence at high levels of the army in particular that we could fulfil this role, that we have enough people equipped to do the job at hand?
Well, I think three key points. One is I'm not talking to senior people in the British military at the moment. I'm very disconnected from them for various reasons. But secondly, it does depend on what the mission is. So if the mission is more one of monitoring and observation and policing it, and if that's done from the air and by satellite and by imagery, then, of course, that's within the capability of NATO and the Europeans generally, not just UK limited, because there's been a coalition of the willing. Talks have been going on between the military chiefs of that coalition of the military for several months now. So they must have a spectrum of options, of strategy, of what that mission might be, and then how and how many troops would be required to deliver those options. So I think all we can do is frankly speculate, because so much depends on the nature of the agreement, the duration of when that's going to be implemented and how it's going to be implemented. And out of that will form any reassurance or security guarantee by the military.
Now, I mentioned at the start that we know that the head of the British military, Admiral Sir Tony Radakin, is on his way to Washington. He's probably there by now. You've no doubt been in situations not dissimilar to this. What is it like as a British, high-ranking British military official to encounter Washington? How are you treated? What is the level of respect?
So much depends on personal relationships. The Americans are very proud, and they are the superpower, and therefore they expect respect and to a certain extent deference, and that's not just the military, but you will have seen that from the European leaders in their handling of Donald Trump in the last few days. So great diplomacy. Great respect, sometimes a little bit of deference and flattery. But if the personal relationship with your American counterpart is good, none of that really matters, because actually, at the end of the day, we are all professional military people. We're all trained more or less in the same way. And whilst we may have in our respective nations different capacities and strengths, the Brits still are held, I think, in pretty high regard by the Americans, even though we've run our defence and our defence capability in numbers considerably down over the last few years.
Yeah, I thought that was a brilliantly diplomatic answer, which hinted that there may be some difficulties occasionally with the Americans. Would that be unfair?
No, it's not unfair at all. And actually, it's not just with the Americans either. You know, every nation has its pride and also has its red lines. I'll give you an example of this. In the Bosnia Stabilization Force, which the European Union then took over, and I commanded the European Union force, which took over from the NATO force, every country comes to these missions, or every troop contingent from a different state comes to these operations with a common mission set by NATO in that case, or the European Union, a common set of operational objectives, a common operation order that's been put together, and a mandate that's approved by all the heads of government. So you come together with what should be an agreed military force and operation. What happens in practice is each of the contingents turns up with some national caveats. So, for example, and these are examples, maybe hypothetical, but not completely illusory, The Spanish might turn up and say, we can't do any military operations that remotely look like civilian operations. So we won't do humanitarian aid operations because that's not in our national thing. We won't do police operations. Many countries won't do police style operations with their military because it's against their constitution. One of the countries that has usually the least of these national caveats are the Brits. And for that, we have a very good relationship with the Americans because I won't say we're free and easy and loose with our operational caveats, not at all. But we tend to be, more operationally effective from the point of view of national caveats. Some other countries, particularly when I was in Bosnia, I experienced it, had national caveats that really were a constraint on the operating capability. And if you as the commander or, you know, as it happened in my case, I gave some instructions and operational order, we were going to mount a big operation. And four of the major contributing states, their contingent commanders came to me and said, look, I'm really sorry, General, but we can't do this because it's in our national caveats that we can't do it. And then I had some interesting discussions with the Chief of Defence of France and Germany. In fact, the German Defence Chief summoned me from Sarajevo to Berlin overnight to explain what I was trying to achieve by this operation and to explain my fury when the Germans refused to participate in it. The German contingent refused to participate in it. We had General Schneiderhahn, I think, was the German general concerned, who I happened to know personally. And I suppose speaking German as I did, it was much easier to have the conversation in his office. And in the end, all these things got ruled out. But it was quite a lively discussion. And the phone call from his office to my office in Sarajevo, I wouldn't have described that as a friendly one either. And the French had a difficulty with the same operation and their national caveats on it. And I actually threatened the contingent commander. I said, look, one of us has got to go. Either you're going to comply with the EU mission that we've been sent, or if you're not going to comply and your country stands behind that, then there's no point in me being here. I shall just go back to UK and get on with my UK military career, not this multinational operational command. I mean, it was, of course, a false threat, but it was relayed back to Paris. And the next day, the French Chief of Defence, who happened to be flying somewhere else, but diverted to come to Bosnia, and he came to see me personally, and we were able to sort it out.
Right, I mean, General, that's quite an insight, that. Thank you very much indeed. That's Lieutenant General David Leakey, former British Army officer. Dale does make the point that sounds to me like a European force is pie in the sky in reality. Does suggest it might be a trifle challenging.
It is 19 minutes past three.
Everything's computer.
Oh, he always crops up, doesn't he? It's time for our tech rundown. We're going to talk to our favourite tech journalist, the only tech journalist we ever talked to. It's Chris Stoker-Walker. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Fee. I'm in a lucky group of one, it seems.
Yes, our favourite group of one. Let's talk about Donald Trump because the White House has launched an official TikTok account. Let's take a listen to the first video.
Every day I wake up determined to deliver a better life for the people all across this nation. I am your voice.
Wow. Well, that is Donald Trump. He is permitting the Chinese-owned platform to operate in the US. Chris, now this is interesting because our very intelligent and perceptive Times Radio listeners may be thinking, I thought Trump was banning TikTok, but here he is on TikTok.
Indeed, the ban axe is still looming for TikTok as well. It is due to fall next month unless Donald Trump changes his mind. And of course, we know that Donald Trump is steadfast in his views and never goes back on them. So we can certainly imagine that TikTok will be banned next month. And if you believe that, then I have a bridge to sell you as well. It is likely, I think, that this ban will just continue to get pushed back and back. Donald Trump actually quite likes TikTok now. I think that he feels comfortable with the idea that it's there. It's worth noting that Donald Trump himself personally had been posting on TikTok all throughout the kind of furore that he's had with TikTok. It is just actually the White House joining here. And I think that is a kind of smoke signal to show that actually the US government rather than just Donald Trump, the president, feels a little bit more comfortable with the supposed national security issues that had blighted TikTok and maybe thinks that actually they're not all that much of a problem at all.
I mean, it's a simple truth, Chris, isn't it, that nowadays in politics you can't not be on TikTok, especially if you want to appeal to a younger part of the electorate.
Yeah, and this is the thing. We have obviously seen that Donald Trump believes that he might want to try and run again, despite the fact that the US Constitution prevents him from doing so. I noted that when we were watching all of the footage of the European leaders and Volodymyr Zelensky appearing at the White House, they were given a little tour of Donald Trump's hat cave, where he had the idea of four more years and Trump 2028. I don't think that that's necessarily going to happen, at least we hope not. But I do think that there is a recognition here that they do need to get their message out to as many people as possible. And the reality is 170 million people use TikTok in the United States. Many of them are the voters of tomorrow. And so it would be churlish for them not to bother trying to communicate to those people.
Can we just pause here for a second and just repeat the phrase Donald Trump's hat cave? Yeah. God, what a time to be alive. Right, the English Premier League kicks off this weekend, and with that comes fantasy football leagues. Now, the Premier League is doing something to shake up fantasy football selections, isn't it?
Yeah, they're going to be introducing an AI chatbot that allows you to quiz it to pick your team in a better way, which, to me at least, and I am fully signed up as a willing participant but not a very good fantasy football player, is a little bit tantamount to cheating, to be honest. I decide to pick my players every single week, and I do so by hand, and invariably I make the wrong decision and end up bottom of the leagues that I am involved in. But I think that that is important, that there are humans in that loop. It's another indication here, Fee, I think, of kind of AI being involved in ruining some of the things that we have and hold so dearly. Because actually, what is the fun if you are not picking the team yourself and competing with each other on a person-to-person basis, but instead you are getting a highly powered computer to pass through the data and then present the team to you that you ought to pick automatically?
Yeah, we've got to wait for the pushback against AI, haven't we? Because we're definitely in that place where everybody seems to think that they need AI in some part of their business or some part of their entertainment or some part of the publishing industry, the creative industry. But there will be a pushback, Chris, won't there? Because as you say, sometimes humans just want to stay doing human things.
Yeah, there will. I think this is one of the things that we're seeing, Fee, is the more that we are being pushed towards AI, the more we are cherishing what it is that makes us human and the connections and the foibles that make us human as well. It just kind of feels like at the minute, everything that we do digitally is getting an AI layer added to it, whether it's a conversation on WhatsApp, whether it is recommendations of how to comment on your friends and family members' posts on Facebook, you know, pre-writing your emails, or even summarising some of the news stories that we see on various websites. It all just kind of feels like there is an added layer of cruft here for AI that isn't necessarily always needed. And I feel like in the fantasy football space, you know, there are some people who would benefit from this. There are certainly an awful lot of kind of statos, people who are really keen on looking at the data and trying to pick the very best team and eking out every advantage that they can find. But the reality is that those players like to do that themselves. They're not really going to want, I don't think, to have a chatbot doing it for them, while at the same time, the sort of fun, I think, of fantasy football is the idea of actually just making mistakes and getting it wrong and then having the conversations with your friends afterwards about how you made a bad decision. So, yeah, I think that actually, if we're talking about the big fight back against AI, fantasy football could well be the front line of that.
Interesting. Now, Britain has dropped its demand for Apple to enable access to the protected encrypted data of American citizens. A lot of words in that sentence, Chris. What does this mean?
Yeah, well, this is also worth caveating that we believe this is the case. We don't actually know, because neither Apple nor the UK has confirmed this. Tulsi Gabbard, who is obviously the US Director of National Intelligence under Donald Trump, has said that is the case on Twitter, on X. This had been a really contentious issue. We talked about this several months ago when it first kind of hovered into view. We learned through a court appeal that turned a secret demand from the UK government to kind of allow the government and law enforcement access to Apple communications through an encrypted backdoor to kind of break the secrecy that users have, in very few exceptions, basically criminal investigations, had been asked for. We knew that Apple had held out against that and said actually they didn't feel comfortable with that. The UK government had appealed that and had gone on for a long time, but it seems like that has gone by the wayside, I imagine, because it doesn't please Donald Trump. And of course, we now know that, you know, in the art of the deal, everything is on the table. And it seems in this instance, this was also the case.
Yesterday, we spoke to the Children's Commissioner, Dame Rachel D'Souza, about her new report into the parlous relationship between children and the online world. She was talking about the government's new age verification rules and VPNs in particular. Chris, I know that you were listening too and you've got some interesting thoughts. Shall we just gather around and hear what Rachel D'Souza had to say?
If a child gets a VPN, they can then access, you know, a child who's addicted gets a VPN, they can access porn. And I think what we've got to say is this loophole of leaving VPNs out of the Online Safety Act needs closing. What does that mean in practice? In practice, that means you've got to age verify when you go on to VPN. That's all we're asking. Now, there seems to be this almost obsession with adults not wanting to verify their age there. And I don't know whether that's because they don't trust the systems, because they're worried about data leaks, whether they there's some sort of shame or worry about what they're doing. I don't know.
So, Chris, what were your thoughts about what Rachel was saying there?
Yeah, I agreed with 95% of what she said. And it was a really fascinating interview. And it was great to see her thinking about this so deeply and kind of, you know, highlighting some of the real issues and the concerns that I think parents rightly have about this sort of stuff. In terms of the kind of not knowing what people have to hide and saying that it's really simple to kind of add age verification to VPNs, well, the whole point of VPNs is that you don't want to be age verified. We have seen that 1,000% increase in VPN downloads plus over the last couple of weeks because of the fact that we have law-abiding citizens who just feel uncomfortable with the idea that actually they have to show their ID or show their face in order to do things that they were perfectly entitled to do and are perfectly innocuous. Not, by the way, even just accessing porn, accessing various random websites that have nothing to do with adult content for a long time. So I think that is really interesting. It was also fascinating to hear Dame Rachel talking about the responsibility of parents. And I do think that there is a risk here in trying to push this onto VPNs and expanding out the idea of age verification, that we overlook the fact that we are often squeamish in talking about this. You know, 80% of parents willingly say that they do not talk to their kids about pornography between the ages of 11 and 13. Only 1 in 5 do. Likewise, they don't necessarily talk about, you know, using the right words for genitalia. Around about half of parents say that they don't do that with their kids. 40% don't talk to their kids about drugs. 70% don't talk about knife crime. The problem here necessarily isn't that we are this isn't a tech problem, basically. This isn't a problem with VPNs. I think this is a problem with parents feeling uncomfortable about talking about these issues. And it was really interesting to hear you probe into that in the question with, for instance, the conversations about the disparity between parents and children knowing about Bonnie Blue or other people like them.
Yeah. All good points well made, Chris. And thank you very much indeed. Jane and I would definitely agree with you on all of those things. We need to talk about things more. And as a parent, you just need to go and pop some things into a search engine so you know what is likely to come up when your kids do exactly the same thing. You don't have to have great powers of imagination to understand what it is that you could put into that search engine.
But you probably will be quite alarmed by what you
see. Yes, you will be. But just imagine then if your 8-year-old self was watching that.
Next on Times Radio, we'll talk about that annoying dolphin. Actually, he's a bit worse than annoying. And we'll also discuss... Thank you. That's coming up in a moment. Let's just have the latest news headlines. Here's Martin Williams.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you.
you very much. Ministers say they're working on contingency plans on where to put asylum seekers. They're expecting legal challenges from councils across the country after a court ruled people should be removed from a hotel in Essex. The judge said the Bell in Epping is not technically being used as a hotel, therefore is in breach of planning rules. Hanif Asif is the director of the Afghan Human Rights Foundation. He says it's important to keep a sense of perspective.
96% of the population who come into Britain, they come legally. But the 4% who come here is making 24/7 headlines. There are predatory men in every part of the society, in every nationality, in every group.
Chancellor Rachel Reeves says while she's stabilised the public finances, there's still more to do to ease the cost of living. UK inflation increased 0.2% to 3.8% last month. A man's been sentenced to 9 years after stabbing his neighbour and shooting a police officer with a crossbow in Buckinghamshire. Jason King, who's 54, pleaded guilty to the attack in High Wycombe in May last year. A member of rap trio Kneecap's been bailed over allegedly supporting a proscribed terror organisation. Liam O'Hanney is accused of displaying a flag in support of Hezbollah at a gig in London in November last year. And prices in the UK rose at their fastest rate in 18 months in July. It was coffee, orange juice, meat and chocolate among the items with the highest cost increases. And for news when you want it, subscribe to our podcasts, The Times News Briefing and The World in 10.
This is Times Radio.
Tesco Finest Sugar Bell Tomatoes, the ultimate supporting act. Zinging up salads or elevating fresh linguine. Perfect for when you want to be vined and dined. It's why only the finest varieties are hand-picked when perfectly ripe to ensure our Sugar Bell tomatoes are exceptionally sweet. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
At This Vet, Mia's the owner, surgeon, rota manager and puppy wrangler. And now she and her team are cybersecurity experts too.
Mia, someone tried accessing our system. Phishing scam. I blocked it.
BT Security Awareness Training turns your team into your first line of defence. Quick to set up from just £1.25 per user per month. Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Thankfully, not just Mia's. Search BT Business Cybersecurity. T&Cs apply. Prices exclude VAT at 20%. 12-month minimum term applies.
Big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 p.m. with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It is, of course, a bottlenose dolphin. This one we're going to talk about is in Dorset, wreaking havoc for swimmers. Right. This is Reggie, who's been filmed alongside holidaymakers, but now appears to be targeting women in wetsuits, and it is claimed that he can pose a threat to humans. Let's talk to Thea Taylor, who's the managing director of the Sussex Dolphin Project. Would this be normal behaviour for a dolphin in our waters, Thea?
Absolutely not. Not really. So solitary dolphins are quite unusual. They're usually very sociable animals and kind of stick to their pods. But when we do get solitary dolphins in the UK, if they get regularly kind of habituated to humans, we can see a slightly nastier side of them.
So, I mean, if we wanted to be sympathetic and empathetic towards Reggie, perhaps he's lost all of his mates. And when he sees a woman coming towards him in a wetsuit, he hopes it's one of his mates, turns out not to be, and he's a bit disappointed.
Yeah, so from what I can tell from kind of the footage that's been going around, Reggie seems to be a young adult male. And when young adult males get a little bit too boisterous to be with the pods, they get kicked out. So it may very well be that this young guy has kind of he's naturally quite boisterous anyway. His behaviour kind of when he was with the family looked more playful, but he'd lost that wariness already. So bottlenose dolphins are normally quite wary around humans. They'll approach, but they'll quite quickly disappear again. They won't kind of physically interact like this one was. They're large animals. They're in their own environment, and they use touch quite a lot kind of within their own species. So it may well be kind of a misidentification, and he's trying to communicate with humans the way he knows how.
So how could he be helped?
The simplest way is for people to stay away from him. Really, he needs to kind of lose the fun element of hanging out with humans. So we almost need to kind of re-sensitize him back to humans, stay away from him, realize that he is a wild animal and should be doing these interactions with his own species rather than us. Mm. It may look cute and fun, and people think dolphins always look happy and smiley. But at the end of the day, staying away from him is the best way that people can help him, encourage him to move off and find his own pod again. Yep.
We do like to imagine a friendly relationship with dolphins, don't we? Swimming with dolphins is in some parts of the world paraded as some kind of an adventure for humans to get to know the wilder environment. And it's not fair on them, actually, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, we're strictly anti-captivity at the Sussex Dolphin Project. Dolphins don't belong in tanks. They are highly intelligent. They have complex social societies. They have their own names, kind of signature whistles. So when you look at all that intelligence, keeping them in captivity for swim with isn't the natural environment they should be in, but it's also not what you'll get if you encounter dolphins in the wild that haven't been trained to be, you know, relatively well behaved around humans. You're seeing a very different animal indeed out in the wild.
How many dolphins are there in UK waters?
Oh, it's anyone's guess really at the moment. I mean, we have 28 different species of kind of cetacean, which is whales, dolphins and porpoises. And along the south coast, we believe we kind of have a small inshore pod of 48 bottlenose dolphins, but then we have kind of transient bottlenose that move through the Northeast Atlantic regularly. So we haven't really got an accurate estimate on dolphin numbers at the moment because they're so difficult to study. But for me, that's one of the things that makes it so exciting because you never quite know what you're going to find out about them.
You said that Reggie was probably kicked out of the pod. Will he be allowed back in if he's done a little bit of time out?
So young adult males quite often form what we call bachelor pods, and that's groups of young adults that have been kicked out of their pods when they kind of hit that late teenager stage, and they'll form a group of young males. They'll go around, harass everybody for a few years, and then they'll eventually kind of settle down and form their own little groups. Right. So hopefully he'll find another group of just as annoying young adult bottlenose dolphins to hang out with for a few years.
We're quite similar, aren't we? So we should look out for Reggie and his mates down the dolphin spoons and try and guide them back in.
I'll just make a point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Reggie doesn't know he's called Reggie.
He doesn't.
What do you think of this pathetic desire we have as humans here to give these creatures names? He's not called Reggie.
Well, we don't know what his name is. Well, he might have his own name. So, yeah, I mean, bottlenose have their own signature whistles. They have their own names for themselves. So, I mean, we're constantly kind of evolving our ability to understand the communications of dolphins. So it may be in a few years' time, we'll be able to find out what his name is for ourselves.
Gosh, I hope so.
It's lovely to talk to you. Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much. Thea Taylor is the Managing Director of the Sussex Dolphin Project. I learnt a lot there.
I thought that was genuinely absolutely fascinating. Lovely to hear about it. Now, this is a really important scandal. It is a scandal, and we all ought to know about it, and we certainly ought to talk about it more, and we certainly should care about it. It's sodium valproate. A medical scandal bigger than thalidomide, but still not something that is on the tip of everybody's tongue. Thousands of children in this country are living with the lifelong impacts of this drug taken by their mothers during pregnancy. And as the years roll by, parents and carers are inevitably getting older and finding life tougher. It has been over a year now since the Patient Safety Commissioner produced a report about how a compensation scheme might work. And absolutely
nothing has happened. The Sunday Times health editor Sean Linton has been following the sodium valproate story for many years, and he began by explaining just who sodium valproate is prescribed to.
So it's mostly prescribed to patients with epilepsy. It's also used in patients with bipolar as well, and some use in migraines as well as that. So for many years, it was a first-line choice drug for epilepsy, even despite known risks of the drug to unborn babies in women of childbearing age. But it's no longer a first-choice drug, or that's certainly the hope anyway from the medicines watchdog.
But is it entirely safe to take if you're a man, for example, or if you're not a pregnant woman?
So valproate is a very effective drug at treating epilepsy. The problem becomes when you're pregnant. And in fact, we know that it can actually affect men as well. It can affect their sperm, and it can. There is emerging evidence, I think it's best to describe it as, which is causing some concern for regulators, that men taking valproate can go on to have disabled children if they obviously have sex with a woman and a baby results. That the baby can be damaged as a result of the men taking valproate. There's still science being done on that, but that is enough of a concern to warrant warnings from the regulators on the use of valproate, both in men and women.
Now, it was first licensed back in the 70s. And when did people begin to report concerns about it?
So almost from the beginning, there were warnings about it. So Sanofi, the manufacturer, actually told the then Medicine Safety Committee that there were sort of warning signs of it in animals, that it could be teratogenic, which means it can affect unborn fetuses. And I think the crucial decision of that committee was to press ahead with using the drug and to effectively hide those risks and those warnings from patients. In fact, they used a phrase about they didn't want to cause fruitless anxiety. And they even, in this day and age, I think, quite a shocking decision. They decided to maybe alert the doctors, but to keep the issue off the patient leaflet so that the public didn't see it, which, you know, is when you think about what we're talking about.
That
there,
really does stink, doesn't it?
It does. It's a bit of, I think it goes back to very paternalistic medicine at the time. But again, as we highlighted in the Sunday Times back in 2022, this committee had been created in the shadow of another huge drug disaster, thalidomide. And so even though their reason for existence was a similar drug issue, they sort of made this decision. And quite frankly, it set the ball rolling for huge amounts of suffering over the decades that followed.
Is it fair to say that this is actually a bigger scandal than thalidomide, in the sense that many, many more people are affected?
Well, we, in the Sunday Times, we called it a scandal worse than thalidomide in 2022. And the reason for that is the estimates are that there are thousands of babies who were affected by valproate. There is a spectrum of that effect. So there are some children who are, you know, so physically disabled they are effectively bedbound and need 24/7 care. There are other children who have learning difficulties and autism, but are able to live a life, you know, but still needing some help and care. And it's everything in between. But there are thousands of those victims. Thalidomide, you know, was a devastating drug, left children physically deformed. It affected hundreds, I think in the order of around 500 to 600 babies. So in that sense, we think valproate is worse. Since our reporting in 2022, the England's Patient Safety Commissioner, Dr. Henrietta Hughes, effectively adopted our headline, and she described it as a scandal worse than thalidomide and validated what our concerns were.
Well, she did more than that. She said these people deserve compensation. Why haven't they had it?
Yeah, well, she did indeed back the Sunday Times call for compensation. And you know, that report is over 18 months old now, and the current Labour government have, I'm afraid, done frankly nothing. They have not explained in any detail any of the work that they say is going on in the background. They provided no details of that, no timeline, no nothing at all to the families. The government, I'm afraid, haven't even said whether they will adopt the principle of redress and paying compensation. This is despite West Streeting, the health secretary, having been photographed with the campaigners for Valparaiso Redress holding a poster saying, I support their group. So I'm afraid the question is with the government, you know, what are they going to do about this scandal? It's accepted by all sides across the House of Commons that redress is necessary. There have been, since Henrietta Hughes's report, there's been over 100 different parliamentary questions from Labour, Conservative, Lib Dem, all kinds of MPs, Green MPs as well. There is a cross-party consensus that this needs to happen, and I'm afraid ministers just haven't done enough yet to tell us even what their thinking is.
Well, it's good to know that at least parliamentarians are attempting to bring it to wider attention. Let's just have a listen to the voice of somebody who's right at the heart of this. This is Branwen Mann. She's now 29, which is an illustration that this isn't about babies and young children anymore. And Branwen has a fetal valproate spectrum disorder. Here she is.
I personally feel let down by everybody. By the IMMDS review, by the government, by all the officials, even by the Patient Safety Commissioner. I mean, there's a reason why a lot of people with Tony Valparaiso don't like to be out there. I think it's because people are just starting to give up, you know?
So Branwen is somebody, I think you've met her family, Sean, is that right?
I've interviewed Branwen a few times, yes. And she is typical of a child with Valparaiso who's now into adulthood. And that, you know, we have to remember this scandal goes back decades. So these children are getting older. And also, crucially, so are their parents. And this is really the issue with Valparaiso. We've got a generation of disabled children. They need care. They need support. People like Branwen have ongoing health issues caused by the drug. She's waiting to have several surgeries because of the effects of the drug on her physical body. And that's true of many of the children I've met, that they have, you know, ongoing physical problems that require medical intervention. But when their parents aren't there, who is going to look after this generation of children? If we don't put in place now the care plans, the cash to support them, to buy their homes, to give them somewhere to live, what we're going to end up with is children being institutionalised who can't look after themselves. They may become frustrated, as children with autism can do. As adults, they may become violent, etc. The risk is that the system, the police, the NHS, etc., throw away the key and put them inside an institution where they won't get the care and live the life that they could. And that will cost the state an absolute fortune.
More.
It would be cheaper to put in place those plans now. Also, these parents, they need that reassurance that their children are going to be looked after, that they're not going to end up being locked up in some grim institution. We already know that that's a problem for children with learning disabilities. So I can't emphasise enough, this is the right thing to do anyway, from just a pure justice perspective. These families were harmed through no fault of their own. This was a state failure. The state owes it to them. But it's also good, cost-effective governance to act now and avoid a bigger bill later on.
What has happened to the manufacturer involved?
So Sanofi have, I think, faced calls for compensation. The inquiry into sodium valproate by Baroness Cumberledge that was published in 2020 did say that they had a moral obligation to contribute any kind of compensation. But the simple reality is Sanofi did warn at various points the regulators about potential risks of sodium valproate. It was the regulators that didn't do what we think they should have done. They hid the warnings. They didn't act quickly enough when the warnings started to emerge. So it's really a regulatory failure. It's a state failure. This isn't an issue really about the drug company failing. Although it's interesting to note that in France, Sanofi has faced prosecution and criminal action over some of the what it knew when in the 1960s when the drug was being discovered and when concerns were raised. And in France, of course, some families are being compensated by the state. So I'm afraid the UK is behind the curve on this.
Right. And the figures involved, is it simply that the government has looked at what they might have to cough up? And I appreciate the point you've made about actually if they don't do something now, it might cost all of us so much more in the future.
but they don't think long term. Governments in a democracy don't really have to, do they? So they might just be thinking, oh, you know what, let's check. We can't. We've got the infected blood scandal. There's the post office compensation that needs to be paid. Frankly, we don't have the money. It's not fair, but do you have any sympathy for that line of thinking?
Well, of course, the government has to manage an economy and manage a public state. I think, however, it is incumbent on any government to stick within the realms of natural justice and to do the right thing. And I think most members of society in Britain would be quite sympathetic to the Valpoate families. No, if they knew someone or had this in their family, they would want the right thing to be done. And I think we also have to do the right thing because it shows to the wider society that the state is behind you when something like this happens and something goes wrong. We will learn lessons from it, we'll do the right thing. As a government, we will move forward in the right direction. I mean, you're right, you raise infected blood. There are other major scandals as well, the post office scandal, etc. There's a bigger question here about the failure of the state over many decades in Britain that have left these huge scandals and the price tags that come with them.
Well, but why does it keep happening?
Well, I think it is a question for, you know, the civil service. The machinery of government is slow to respond to warning signs. We saw that with the post office scandal. We saw it with infected blood. We've seen it with Valpoate. There were signs there. There were alerts raised. But the machinery of government, the machinery of the NHS and the regulators sometimes puts, you know, it's that in the too difficult pile. Or the reputation of the NHS or the government needs to be protected. And actually it's that unwillingness to accept difficult conversations, difficult truths that might be emerging, which means there's a temptation to cover up. And I think we've certainly seen that in Valpoate. And I think the government needs to learn the lessons from this. And I'm afraid it needs to pony up. These families were not harmed through any action of their own. This was done to them by a failure of the state, and it has a responsibility. And I think West Streeting knows this. I'm hoping that there's some serious work going on behind the scenes, because he needs to go and meet some of these families, see how they're living. They're scratching a living on benefits. Some of them are being dragged to benefit tribunals to justify their disability from what is a lifelong condition that will never get better, and yet they're constantly being put under pressure. These lives have been stolen from these children and their parents, who have to care for them 24/7. This was all done to them. It's time for the government to do the right thing.
Well, I think everyone listening will think, yeah, we've got to step up, or they've got to step up. West Streeting has said, I think, that he has sleepless nights about the state of maternity services. Maybe you should be having a few sleepless nights about this as well.
Absolutely. I think if I was West Streeting, there'd be a lot of things keeping me up at night. He's got a huge, difficult job, and you know, he's coming in after, you know, 15 years of delayed decisions and underfunding for the health service, as we've seen across the country in other sectors. There's a lot of work to be done. He's prioritising certain things. I'm afraid the Valpoate children need some prioritisation.
He's so passionate about this, and it's such an important issue. That is Sean Linton, who's the Sunday Times health editor, talking about the many, many thousands of people impacted by the sodium valproate scandal. And the young woman you heard from in the middle of that interview, Branwen Mann, we've been in contact with her today, and we're very much hoping that she will be on the programme in the autumn and tell us more about what her life is like and just how it's been impacted by the drug.
It will be very good to hear from her. It is coming up to 4:05.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Black Mirror, Dad.
Let's watch it over the bank holiday. That
be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
Four.
That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV. Plus, change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary. Terms apply.
Tesco Finest Sugar Bell Tomatoes. The ultimate supporting act. Zinging up salads or elevating fresh linguine. Perfect for when you want to be vined and dined. It's why only the finest varieties are hand-picked when perfectly ripe to ensure our Sugar Bell tomatoes are exceptionally sweet. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
£1.49 at McDonald's gets you a mini Oreo McFlurry. £1.49 on a big night out gets you...
Sorry, no trainers.
McDonald's Saver Menu. Actually get your money's worth. From 11am. Price and participation may vary. Fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
Ah, claim approved. Direct Line's ready to send my new laptop within 2 hours. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like teaching little Johnny to play his recorder.
Oh, my.
That's my boy!
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Theft and accidental loss claims up to £3,000. Cover limits apply. Personal possessions cover needed for items outside the home.
This is Times Radio.
Now, we've got a good guest around the same time tomorrow. It is Fee.
It's Sophie Watson. Now, she got in touch with us on the podcast, which is off air, drops at six every evening. A wide-ranging variety of topics are regularly discussed. And we were talking about cities not really being able to cope with the heat. And this summer in London and across parts of the United Kingdom, there have been some people who've really struggled with the new builds in particular and, you know, temperatures topping 30 degrees. So Sophie Watson wrote to us. She is a professor in urban planning and she's going to come on and we're just going to have a fantastic conversation about how you build cities for modern life and what needs to be done and what definitely shouldn't be done.
Well, that sounds very interesting. That's tomorrow afternoon.
It is.
Now, the podcast that my colleague mentioned there is Off Air with Jane and Fee. And at the moment on the podcast, we're discussing it is light and shade. It's ranging widely. It really is. There's a very serious email, actually, on today's Off Air. And we really are grateful to the anonymous contributor who's sent us this experience. And we very much look forward to you chipping in with your thoughts on it. But there's also quite a lot of chat about big cats. Now, we had dolphins earlier. It is August, but big cats. And this is just, it's been a fact for all my journalistic career going back thousands of years now, that big cats only roam the UK in August, by and large, an occasional sighting in July. But we couldn't believe our luck because we had an email today from Rick Minter, who is Britain's big cat expert. Couldn't believe it, could we?
So he had heard about his work being discussed on the podcast. So we are hoping to book him as a big guest as well. Yeah. And one of our delightful listeners, Sean and Caterham, send us a very funny email because we were talking about the new big cat sightings, which all appear to be a black panther corrected to a black leopard. And Sean pointed out that if you can actually have a leopard that had spots and then turns into a black leopard, it slightly decries the myth that a leopard never can change its spots.
I tell you what, it was worth getting to the end of that.
Almost.
What's happened to the screen? I don't know. Our screens, I think in tribute to Fee's telling of that anecdote, have just gone completely bananas.
And now it's just faded.
It's just
very, much, very much like me. I can't really go at it at 2 minutes to four.
Well, you had a good bash. Right, who do we want to thank today? Well, our producer was Kia Browning and our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. And John Pienaar is hoving into view. He's got drive for you between 4 o'clock and seven. Have a very good night. Thanks for listening.
across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. And at 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Ministers say they're working on contingency plans for where to put asylum seekers after the Epping court decision. And a rapper accused of displaying a flag of the terror group Hezbollah at a gig has been released on bail. And coming up, I'm going to be talking to the leader of a local council looking to follow the actions of Epping. And with the reality of the Eastern Front unchanged, I'll be talking to the Defence Minister of Lithuania, who is developing a 30-mile-deep defensive line on the border with Russia.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Martin Williams.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. The leader of Broxbourne Council says it's seeking advice on how to block a local hotel housing asylum seekers. It's one of several in England launching legal action after a High Court injunction meant migrants being required to vacate the Bell in Epping in Essex. The government says it's working on contingency plans for housing asylum seekers. David Goodcart from the Policy Exchange think tank says the existing migrant rules need to change.
Everybody now agrees the refugee conventions and the ECHR rules and regulations were designed for a world in which very few people could move. Now people, if you live in a poor country or an authoritarian country, you look on your TikTok and you see what a great life we have in these countries, you want to move, so you move. And we have to stop that, and we have to select the people who really are in need.
A rapper accused of displaying a flag of the terror group Hezbollah at a gig has been released on bail. Kneecap's Liam O'Hanney's been told he'll find out in a month's time if his charge is being thrown out after his defence team told a court there was a technical error in the way he was charged. The 27-year-old hasn't yet entered a plea. Israel says around 60,000 reservists have been called up in preparation for a renewed offensive on Gaza City. Hamas has belatedly accepted fresh ceasefire proposals that would include half the remaining Israeli hostages in Gaza being freed in exchange for more Palestinian prisoners. Gabriel Weiniger is Tel Aviv correspondent at The Times.
We have seen Israel go into that Hamas stronghold over the past 2 years, but there are some places where they haven't entered, particularly in the central refugee camps, which are crowded, narrow, full of buildings. They're going to be heavily booby-trapped. Israel is basically planning this very precise and very large operation to take over that city and rid it of its Hamas militants. That's going to be a very, very tough fight for them.
8 new people and companies have been added to the UK's sanctions list targeting Russia. The government says it's freezing the assets of individuals and firms using financial systems and crypto networks based out of Kyrgyzstan. Officials say Russian agents are channeling money through other countries to evade economic punishments. And scientists are warning a dolphin, popular with swimmers off the Dorset coast, could become aggressive. Reggie's been filmed targeting female holidaymakers in wetsuits off Lyme Bay. A photo of the bottlenose playing alongside swimmers has gone viral online. Thea Taylor is the managing director of the Sussex Dolphin Project.
Reggie seems to be a young adult male. When young adult males get a little bit too boisterous to be with the pods, they get kicked out. So it may very well be that this young guy has kind of he's naturally quite boisterous anyway. Bottlenose dolphins are normally quite wary around humans. They'll approach, but they'll quite quickly disappear again. They won't kind of physically interact like this one was.
And don't forget, you can set the Times News briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. And ministers won't say where they may send asylum seekers, those who are having to move out of that hotel in Essex and those who will have to check out when more court orders come in, because the government doesn't know the answer. The official line is that ministers want to avoid handing hard right-wing agitators info that they'll use to drum up support and plan a new wave of protests. And maybe they're right about that risk. But the obvious truth is that no one knows where asylum seekers might be housed. Empty tower blocks, old army camps, they might also be ruled out by a judge. They may be ruled to be a breach of the planning laws. And meanwhile, the small boats keep coming. And according to the polls, public hostility to the whole idea of housing asylum seekers in local communities keeps growing. Not necessarily because people want to treat asylum seekers harshly, apart from those who do, or who see worried and fearful locals as a handy source of political support. It's maybe more that a lot of people who want to see homeless asylum seekers treated at least decently would rather they were treated decently somewhere else. And let's be fair, not everyone who feels that way can fairly be called an extremist or a racist, can they? None of which even begins to answer the question, what does the government do now? Where do asylum seekers turned out of hotels go next? So let's address those questions and others on today's show. Have you any suggestions, any thoughts? Because they're all welcome. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First then, asylum hotels across the country are bracing for legal challenges after that High Court ruling that asylum seekers should be removed from a hotel in Epping. Chris Whitbread is the leader of Epping District Council, and he told Times Radio that the ruling was a win for ordinary people.
There are people who will protest, and peaceful protesters always have a role to play in these things. But of course, more importantly, it's just talking to everyday people walking up and down the high street and their concerns for their children, their families, and everything else. Yesterday's victory over the temporary injunction was for students, residents, and the businesses of Epping Forest who deserve to be able to get on with their lives.
Now, last month, Times Radio visited Epping and spoke to people living there.
I've lived in Epping for many, many years, 17 years in total, and this is a lovely little safe town, a lovely place to bring up children. Since the hotel has been housing men, it's become unsafe. We've had numerous letters home from school saying, warning our children that girls are being approached in the high street.
A lot of local businesses are having to close. It's affecting them badly. I know a lot of residents don't want to come out at night. It's scary, so it's not been good. 2 years ago, we had a load of families over there, children and mothers. No trouble, and no one cared. But now, it's all single men. I do agree with the peaceful protest and that people want them out. I do agree with it.
Now, let's talk first to Max Kendix, the political reporter at the Times. Hello to you, Max.
Hello there.
Max, what's your thought on where we are now? The High Court